This is Thinking in Public, a program dedicated to intelligent conversation about frontline theological and cultural issues with the people who are shaping them. I'm Albert Moeller, your host and president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. Dr. Alan C. Gelzo is professor of humanities in the Hamilton School of Classical and Civic Education at the University of Florida. Professor Gelzo previously served as director of the James Madison Program and as a senior research scholar at Princeton University. He earned his PhD from the University of Pennsylvania, and since that time, he has authored numerous award-winning publications. He's written for outlets such as the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, First Things, and others. Professor Gelzo is a distinguished historian of the American experience. His book, Gettysburg, The Last Invasion, enjoyed 8 weeks as a New York Times bestseller. That book, along with his works on Abraham Lincoln, Robert E. Lee, the Civil War, and the Battle of Gettysburg, all those were the topic of previous episodes of Thinking in Public. In his most recent book, The Golden Thread, A History of the Western Tradition, well, that is the topic of our conversation today. Professor Alan Gelzo, welcome to Thinking in Public.
Thank you so much, sir.
As always, it's wonderful to have the conversation with you. We've been having conversations of one sort or another going back several decades, and I'm very thankful for that.
And I'll do my very best to see that I continue to provide material for ongoing conversations into the future.
Well, I will say you have certainly seen to that with the massive work we're going to be discussing today. I love books, and engaging with books is a major part of my life. There are books I read, and I think, you know, this one's really important. There are other books I read, and I think this is lastingly important. You have devoted an enormous amount of your life and professional commitment to the publication of the second volume in this project to the defense of Western civilization. So why that? Why now?
Because we're looking at a moment of civilizational crisis. Mm-hmm. I know everyone likes to talk about the crisis that they have a solution for, but I'm not talking about anything quite as small scale as that. We are talking about a dramatic loss of confidence in this thing that we call Western civilization or the Western tradition. Mm-hmm. And that loss of confidence is actually something that's been going on for quite a long time. It's not something that happened 3 months ago or 3 years ago. If anything, you can make a direct trace back more than a century to the beginning of a certain decay of confidence in the Western tradition, to the point now where that decay has become what Matthew Arnold once called a long withdrawing roar. And it's in the face of that that we have had to look very seriously at what is at stake and to deal with this indifference, a really studied indifference to Western civilization.
Right, quite calculated.
And that's what these books set out to address.
The two volumes are massive. The first, together, the project, The Golden Thread, A History of the Western Tradition, Volume 1, The Ancient World and Christendom, by Professor James Hankins of Harvard, and then Volume 2, The Modern and Contemporary West, that you have contributed. I've thoroughly enjoyed both volumes. But I want to come back at the title because, people could look at this and think, well, in the 1950s, there'd be, and of course, the subtitle of the book is A History of the Western Tradition. And I think those three words are just so explosive when put together these days. And I delight in it. But let's face it, you say a history of the Western tradition. Every one of those words is controversial today.
Yes, they are, shall we say, loaded. Mm-hmm. And they're chosen with deliberation, not an accident, not something that we ran past an advertising agency so that we could have a catchy title. We talk about the golden thread, first of all. Well, this in itself is a reference to the classical past, and it invokes the famous legend of Theseus and the Minotaur. And after Theseus confronted and slew this monster, the Minotaur, he had to find his way out of the cave in which he found himself, the cave which had been the Minotaur's, well, shall we say, palace. And how is he able to do that? He is able to do that by means of a golden thread which will lead him back to the light. And in a very real sense, this is one of the things we would like to see these books accomplish. They are a golden thread that take us back to a moment of light, to many moments of light. So we start right away with a classical invocation. Then we have what you might call the cheek to talk about a history of the Western tradition. Let me dwell for a moment on the word history, because Hankins and I are both historians.
Right.
And we dwell on the history of things very largely because history is the great meta-narrative. Everything has a history. And even those disciplines, even those pursuits which don't think of themselves as being connected to history, nevertheless, they have one. And history is a way of shaping, understanding, clarifying, sometimes condemning, at other times exalting, what has happened in events and with people that are no longer here to talk about them directly to us. There are many people who are very dubious about this exercise that we call history. Some people, in a very practical sense, simply say, well, it's very boring. It's all dates and names and places. Well, dates and names and places are important, just like the scaffolding of a great cathedral is important when you're constructing it. Not pretty to look at, but you're never going to get the cathedral without the scaffolding. But in a larger sense, we deal with history because many people resent history today. And this is particularly true in times of despotism, times of authoritarianism, times of tyranny. What else do tyrants love to destroy except a people's history? Because when they can do that, there's nothing for people to appeal to from whatever atrocities are being committed in the present. Nothing to compare what the present looks like to something in the past. So, of course, we talk a great deal about wanting to think about and face toward the future. But in fact, many of the people who talk in that way really aren't interested in the future at all, don't even really have a clear idea of the future. What they really want to do is shape the past. And unless we are aware of the forces, both positive and negative, that wish to gain control of history, then we become vulnerable in the most childish and the most vulnerable way. So, yes, we are writing a history with all of those things very much in mind. And then we're writing a history of the Western tradition. We call it tradition rather than civilization, because strictly speaking, what the West is composed of is a series of civilizations. We begin, for instance, with the Greeks. We move to the Romans. We move to Christendom. We move to the Age of Reformation. We move to the Enlightenment. We move to modern times. Each of these are like layers in a cake, and each of them has dynamic and literature peculiar to themselves, not to say also personalities peculiar to themselves. So we see what we think of sometimes as just simply Western civilization is really made up of a series of civilizations, each of which has drawn with and interacted with the other. And when we see the layers build up to this thing we call the Western tradition.
Yeah, there's also a very clear sense, though, that this is a civilizational project. There is a continuity to it that is also as important as the disparities you mention.
Yes.
And so I appreciate the word tradition. I'll just defend using the word civilization simply because I'm rather committed to it. And so I'll admit it's civilizations, but I think there is a larger civilizational project. And it is interesting that there's a self-conscious sense of continuity in those successor civilizations. I mean, even from Greece to Rome, you know, the Romans intentionally and explicitly sought to say, we are the successor.
Yeah. Oh, the great epics of Roman history, mm-hmm. and Roman self-consciousness were all built upon this notion that somehow what had been the mm-hmm. triumphs of Greece made their transition to Rome. Hence, you get right. Virgil. I mean, Virgil's the right. one who's going to make that point in the most dramatic fashion.
Now, this is a two-volume work. As I say, Professor Hankins wrote the first volume. And, you know, I thought when reading his volume, I thought, well, number one, this is extremely well done. I appreciate so much the way he's done it. This is the easier task. And then I noticed on the very first printed page of your volume, in the note to the reader, you acknowledge something. I think this is very well put. You say volume two has the sadder task of showing, particularly in the 19th and 20th centuries, all the places where the Western tradition basically started to fall behind, this sadder task. I think it's a more interesting task, but you did get the difficult assignment here.
Well, I made the observation to Jim Hankins that he had the pleasant burden of rolling the stone up to the top of the hill, whereas mine is getting in front of the stone, trying to keep it from rolling all the way to the bottom and further. So, yes, there is a sense in which I can say I had a harder time of it, which is a way, I suppose, of paying myself a compliment I don't deserve. But yes, the task is, in a lot of ways, daunting, because in the second volume, you have to address most directly this whole notion of civilizational crisis and where it came from. And how do we confront it? How do we understand it? How do we deal with it ourselves? And how do we preserve some of the great characteristics of this thing we call the Western tradition, even though we are quite consciously living in an age which has lost its confidence in the characteristics and in itself?
Let me ask you a quick question, very quick, and we'll come over this territory again. But so when did that happen? When did that sense of civilizational doom or exhaustion arise?
If I have to put my finger on a date, and that's always very risky, I'd probably put it on 1918. I would put it on 1918 because it is at that moment that the long arc of Western civilization commits what very nearly amounted to an act of suicide, and that was the First World War. A useless, needless war characterized by people who had allowed the mechanisms of government and the state to grow beyond their control, and which was waged with a savagery indistinguishable from barbarism. And at that point, you stepped back and wondered, are we really civilized after all? Or have we simply put a very thick coating of sugar on what was really a continuing barbarism all along? And you see this emerge in the writing of an extraordinary number of people, the most obvious being Oswald Spengler's Decline of the West. But you see it in so many other places in the literature after the First World War. I won't, of course, exclude the fact that there were a number of voices in the decades leading up to the First World War, which, if they did not actually prophesy this kind of collapse, nevertheless are pointing in that direction. In that respect, I think particularly of Friedrich Nietzsche. But I would also include under that umbrella Sigmund Freud, and then naturally Karl Marx. We were tending in a certain direction, but the arc of confidence did not collapse until we began to dig the trenches of the Western Front. And coming out of that experience was a stupendous shock to our confidence in ourselves, a shock made worse by what we then proceeded to do in the two decades after the Versailles Treaty, and then indulged in another world conflict whose dimensions were even more barbaric, if that could be imagined, than those of the First World War. So that we have been left for a long time clinging to a kind of negative confidence, a negative confidence that says, well, we have to hold on as much as we can to things we call civilization because we don't like the alternative, especially the ideological alternative posed, let us say, by the Soviet Union and those regimes that imitated the Soviet Union. Once the Soviet Union was off the table, once ideology had ceased to be the matter of immediate consequence, we suddenly woke up and realized that all along there had been bubbling a conflict of civilization, not just of ideology. And it is in the midst of that we now find ourselves today.
I finished a very large book project tracing the civilizational crisis, and just finished it a matter of months ago. And what I've turned to now is a very in-depth study that I had just had to put off for years, just given, as you understand, things pile up and the urgent winds. But I have been saving this up, and I've decided, okay, now I've got to do it. So late at night, I am diving deeply into literary projects that emerged immediately after the First World War. And it's heartbreaking material. It's also, from a Christian perspective, just absolutely fascinating, because there are only two answers coming out of this, and that is that there is some truth worth defending, or there is not. And that becomes very, very clear. This has been an ongoing debate. I want to say that one of the great achievements of your work here, I'm going to say first, before I even make that point, one of the great achievements of your work is that you make all of this very interesting. So as a boy, I have been fascinated with Western civilization. I find so many common interests with others in the English-speaking world, the Anglosphere, who have caught on to the story at a very young age and just wanted to spend a life, you know, getting to know the story better. And so the idea of Western civilization, by my reckoning, was central to the American project. So much so that when I was in high school, we basically were taught a civilizational reality that not only was worth defending, but was presented as superior to all others. And then I didn't know there was any problem until I was in my last 2 years of high school, where I started reading more broadly and discovered, well, you know what? I don't think my teacher is up to date on this discussion. And so I walked right into it. I walked right into it through Kenneth Clark's work on civilization. And you cite it with in your book. I can just tell you that that became a major intellectual turning point in my life, because he presented issues I had to think about. I wasn't prepared to think about. Wasn't even sure how to start thinking about them. I want to say what I wish is that your book had been available to me at that point, because it would have been enormously helpful. And so, forgive me, but I just want to say I think you are serving this generation and generations to come just incredibly well with this book. I commend it in the highest possible terms. I have so many questions. One of them is, how in the world did you organize this? How did you write? I mean, there's a chronological pattern, but you incorporate so much material. How in the world did you do this?
I don't know.
But this is quite different than writing about the Civil War or no. Writing. You know, this is basically, I'll just say, to round it off, this is a millennium or the better part of one.
This is an interesting question. People sometimes have asked me a somewhat similar question, and that mm-hmm. is, how do you go about the process of writing what you do, and so on and so forth like that. And my response to them is, well, you know, this is difficult to say, because I was never part of a writer's school or a writer's camp or anything like that. No one ever taught me how to write, okay?
Other than all the authors you had read.
Well, yes. I was not a history major.
Right.
I have to admit, I hope this doesn't shock anyone, I never took a course on, for instance, the Civil War. And yet this is what I've spent a great deal of time writing about. The only thing I can offer as something of an explanation, it comes from John Bunyan. And Bunyan evidently had the question put to him, because in the prologue to Pilgrim's Progress, he describes the writing of Pilgrim's Progress as an image that came to his mind, and then he said, as I pulled, it came. And I remember that C.S. Lewis, in an essay that he wrote about Bunyan, once said that he didn't think there was really any better description of the creative process. And that's what I take refuge in. I sit down with these things. I want to explain them. I want to try to make them as clear and their relationships as clear as possible. And I try to do it broadly. I suppose one example that was set for me was set very early on when I was a teenager, watching Kenneth Clark's great series, Civilization. And being...
That's what I mentioned. We had the same experience at the same age.
Yeah. Just being so impressed by the connections that Clark drew. And almost saying to myself, I would like to do things like this. So there is a seed that is planted in the example of someone like Clark. Not only, I have to say, in Civilization, I've actually found even more persuasive the subsequent series that he did and the book connected to it on the Romantic Rebellion. And the thumbprint of that is very apparent in the chapter on Romantic art. But that was a step in that direction.
And can I interrupt you to say that what surprised me about Kenneth Clark was when I found out what a pessimist he was about the future of Western civilization.
Oh, I know.
I didn't know that as a 16, 17-year-old. So as a college student,
and
I've
get
come
a whiff
across
of
this.
That. You get a whiff of that in the concluding chapter of
Absolutely.
Civilization.
Yeah. You understand it better once you know that. He also, you know, he had separated himself, at least for most of his life. It's questionable, I understand, from his family about the very end of his life. But for most of his life, he had separated himself from any commitment to Christianity. And kind of lived the life in the gilded life of the aristocratic British with all the complications thereof. And he had a very secular viewpoint on this. And I knew there had to be a better way of telling this story that wouldn't include less than he had, but would put it in a larger context. And I don't think that exists until your book. I mean, I don't want to overclaim, but let me just say that I've been looking for this book since I was 17. So thank you. Finally, you deliver. But I mean, there was nothing like this available.
Well, I'm stepping back from the long train of narrative, of evidence, of history, of literature, of art, and I'm asking the question, at what corner did we turn? Why are we in the place we are in? And sometimes you look for addition and sometimes you look for subtraction. In this second volume, you're very much looking for the subtraction. And to me, the great subtraction is the subtraction of Christianity. This is, if I can go
That's
back,
Charles that's, Taylor's term for it.
Well, yes. Here's the thing. I referred already to Arnold's famous poem, Dover Beach. And what was Arnold lamenting? He was lamenting the withdrawal of the sea of faith. And to him, that meant the undermining, the changing of everything, so much so that the only thing that was left were rootless individuals whose only hope was some kind of personal connection to each other. So he says, ah, love, let us be true to one another. And then he goes on saying, all these other things we thought were so stable and so permanent, they aren't. And I think, all right, there we are. Okay, how did we get that? What caused that? And I think that especially in the 19th century, there are several important developments which speak to that. One is Darwin, one is Marx, another is Freud. And these are game changers in how we understand ourselves. They're game changers even for people who've never read Marx, never read Darwin, and never read Freud. Doesn't matter. We have inherited, almost by a kind of intellectual osmosis, the assumptions there. And the assumptions that are built into Darwin and to Marx and to Freud are ones which are fundamentally hostile to the unity that Christianity offers in the creation of a civilizational synthesis. These are elements that tell us that there is nothing to synthesize, that we are the products of happenstance, and that whatever order there is to be in the world is not something to be discovered as either true or beautiful, but something which is confected by the application of our own love of power. And that becomes the message.
Often called the love of something else.
Well,
like
I'm
the
using,
people.
I'm using the word power in a very broad sense, but it has, you might say, a lineage back to the Garden of Eden when the serpent promises, you shall be as gods. Well, what else is that except the promise, you will be in control. You will have power over yourselves and your environment. And that promise has been repeated over and over again in our own times, and almost always at the cost of blood, of treasure, and ultimately of purpose and confidence. So what do we see when we look in the mirror? It's not pretty. What the golden thread wants to do is to say, is it not possible to think that we might have made a mistake at some point, that we might have diminished ourselves, that we might have thrown away a great benefit? And if we have, can we yet retrieve it? In a sense, that is what Volume 2 is asking.
You set out to tell the story, and you have to begin somewhere, and I assume this was in a conspiracy with your co-author in this project. He had to end, and you had to begin. And so I do think it's very interesting where you begin. And the very first substantial part of the book is entitled A World of Families.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I loved it. But I do think you're making a point that would be rejected by almost everyone in the leftist academy. There's something very organic about the way you tell the story. In other words, you're deeply committed to reality, and I appreciate the way that you, for instance, you do a lot of work recognizing what, you know, in the academy a generation or two ago would have been called, you know, an approach from below. But you don't deny the importance of history from above. You blend them together, and I think in a marvelous way.
Well, that's very kind of you to observe that, because it does reflect my own interest, my own reading. It also reflects my own, shall we say, apprenticeship as a history person, and that apprenticeship was very largely built around the dynamics of social history, of history from the bottom up. And I learned, whether I liked it or not, I had to learn that the world was made up of more than simply eggheads like myself, that there are large-scale organizations of society which have something of their own dynamic, but they don't entirely control it. And this was where I ended up dissenting from many of my contemporaries. Because at the same time as you recognize the impact of great movements, of large-scale movements historically, ultimately the decisions that are made historically are usually made by a small number of people, a few people, not necessarily great, not necessarily well-placed or well-born, but a small number of people who either have the advantage of position or who else perceive and articulate a direction that other people will then follow them in pursuing. And it is at the blend of those two things that I try to write a great deal of what I do in the history, not only my specialty, but in this larger context.
A couple of other aspects that I want us to talk about, and I need to go back for just a moment. When we were talking about even the end of World War I and the civilizational crisis that came, it wasn't evenly distributed. It was far more, I think, based in what you are presenting on the European side of the Atlantic than the American side of the Atlantic. The way I often refer to this is that World War I saw the American public and the American military basically go in like a 14-year-old and come out like an 18-year-old. That was, it grew up a very great deal. But it, what it thought on the other side of it was that America now has an unexpected but unquestioned leadership position and posture in the world. At the same time, Europe, old Europe, and even my heroes in old Europe are seeing the end of a civilization. And even like someone like a Winston Churchill recognizes the best he can hope for is a union of the English-speaking peoples in terms of moral purpose, because Britain is in decline. Didn't he know it? And the U.S. was this resurgent power. When I was a teenager, and we're about the same age, when I was a teenager, that same sense of American ascendancy was very much a part of the culture. But by the time I graduated from college, in the academic world, it had been reversed. I will just tell you, I think that's one of the most remarkable intellectual, changes. And so no one really at that time among my college professors, and I had some great college professors, none of them saw the need for this kind of project. Evidently, they didn't do it. They might not see a market for it. You're making this as far more of an argument than would have been the case 50 years ago. You're making a very serious argument about the importance of the Western tradition and about what has been lost.
Mm-hmm. I think I'm making that argument because I am fundamentally afraid. Afraid of the worship of power, afraid of the rejection of history, afraid of barbarism. And again, I'm using the term barbarism not in the way we often do, thinking of primitive tribes dressed in skins. All right, that's the image that comes to mind. No, when I'm talking about barbarism, I'm thinking about something that's much closer to us. Because I'm thinking about barbarism as something which is composed of a loss of self-control, composed of destructive religions, or in some cases, destructive anti-religions, that involve ultimately human sacrifice of various sorts. And isn't it not peculiar how the most destructive forms of religion almost always come back to human sacrifice? They may gussy it up with some kind of terminology, but yes, it comes down to human sacrifice. And barbarism is also, at least in my mind, it's bound up with illiteracy. It's bound up with indifference to the past, especially the classical past. And it expresses itself in ugliness. Ugliness in art, it glorifies ugliness in art, in literature, in music, in architecture, because so much of it is growing out of the determination of people to express themselves as the possessors of power, power that overrides,
right,
and is unrestrained by any kind of natural order. I mean, in music, for instance, I think very dramatically in the years after World War I, the popularity of the Second Viennese School, of atonality, the notion that tonality should not govern what you hear. Rather, music should be written mathematically in a formula that has nothing to do with what it sounds like, but is purely a matter of abstract relations on paper. That is an obsession with ugliness, and an ugliness that, right, is connected with an obsession with technology.
I mean, I don't write down to architectural styles that would even call themselves brutalism.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But when do we see the beginnings of this? All right, we have some preliminary tremors prior to 1914, no question. But where do we really see it exfoliate? We see it in the decades after World War I, and we see it all around us still today.
Right. And we saw it first in Germany and the Bauhaus School and all this. But it doesn't stay there, and pretty soon it comes right over.
This is symptomatic of what I call barbarism. Because when you look at classical architecture, what are you looking at? You're looking at a remarkable blend of civic ideas. Look at the Parthenon. You're looking at a blend of civic ideals with engineering, making them work together. What we have done now is we have pulled them apart. We've sacrificed the civic ideals, and now we have only the experiments in engineering, which we then twist in a direction that says, let us make this so ugly that we clearly owe nothing to the canons of beauty. We, in fact, are expressing ourselves purely as an explosion of power.
I found this, just some of these things just come back again and again in very interesting ways. A part of my understanding of all of this was really the gift of Kenneth Clark by his failure, not his success. I was just astounded by the fact that he gets to modern art and he can't do anything but celebrate it because of his elite status in the culture. So he really violates everything he had written for about 400 pages, you know, to then turn to this. You know, in his biography, it mentions that his house, you know, looked like something from the 19th century. Well, okay, I understand that. But he's celebrating all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I fast forward now to Donald Trump, president of the United States, who hates the brutalist buildings in Washington, D.C., and wants to go back to a neoclassical architecture. And there was a fascinating piece in the Washington Post in which they said, basically, this is barbarism. This is President Trump's a barbarian. You know, who is he to deny all of the meaning of this art? And then there's the acknowledgement, but you know what? The people are pretty much with him on this. People who live in Washington, they pretty much agree with him. I wonder why.
And it is true across the board. So it's not only public architecture in Washington. It's public architecture, very generally understood, and is there's. But you see, there's also a way to fumble this. There's a way to understand. Yes, we feel a great loss. The loss that bound together those civic ideals with the engineering. And we want to get it back, but we only want to get it back with the engineering. We want to go back
exactly
to
another kind of,
which is hollow.
Yeah.
So yes, there are movements out there. Yes, we'd like to have classical architecture back again, but I'm not going to be entirely persuaded until what I also see is that connected with that engineering are the civic ideals. You know, the remarkable thing about Golden Age Athens is the great architecture went into the public buildings. I mean, the way people had to, the people of Athens had to live in terms of their day-by-day existence, that was a very different matter. No one's building monuments to that. They poured their efforts into their public buildings because their public buildings captured who they were. And until we understand thoroughly that what we're doing in our public architecture is speaking about what is important to us, that speaks about the rhythm and the natural order of law in nature. Until we understand how those work together, then our engineering is simply going to be like picking up antiques at a flea market.
That's true, but I'm going to push back a little bit. I'm with Pierre L'Enfant on this when he said the buildings are going to teach regardless of whether or not people read them the first time. In other words, there's still a statement being made here.
Yes, and you can make an argument that says the buildings, people shape the buildings and then the buildings shape the people.
Right.
And I won't eliminate that entirely, but to expect the buildings alone to do it, to accomplish that, without a conscious commitment to the civic ideals, then what you are liable to wind up with are simply empty buildings.
You sound dangerously like President George Washington. I appreciate that, because that was one of his deep concerns. The Republic will not last beyond its fundamental commitments. He also set out Washington and actually hired L'Enfant and was at least a party to firing him too. But anyway, just to make certain that Washington, the city, or what he would refer to as the capital city, made a statement reasserting, and I think this is so important to your project here, reasserting Rome and Greece in terms of continuity to the American Constitutional Republic. I find that grand. I love it.
What we are talking about here is not simply politics. It is this notion of a great tradition that has its elements that we owe to Greece, that we owe to Rome. And it's not simply because we can speak in terms of admiring their technique. What were the Greeks trying to capture? What was Herodotus trying to capture when he describes at the very beginning of his history? He's trying to describe what made the Greeks different from the Persians, what made the Greeks triumph. And for Herodotus, it came down to one thing. The Greeks loved Eleutheria. They loved freedom. And everything grew out of that. Everything that Herodotus describes grows out of that fundamental conviction. Absent that conviction, then you have nothing but empty spaces.
Mm-hmm. You know, you're an historian, I'm a theologian. I know you're also very learned in theology, and I'm very much a student of history. But as a theologian, I have to say, I found your treatment of the massive roar of withdrawal. I felt you traced very importantly the theological developments, the loss of the authority of theology in the academy and then in the culture. And I think you trace the fact that there is no successor to that. There's no successor to belief in God.
No, and if there is to be another layer, so to speak, if we are to see ourselves as having an opportunity to create another level here, what we can say with some confidence is that Christian belief will be taken up into that. You see, the layers of this thing we call the tradition, the Western tradition, are not erasures. I mean, as you said earlier, the Romans do not erase the Greeks. They take the Greeks, they build upon it. Likewise, with Rome and Greece, what Christendom, even in the Dark Ages, does is to take the Romans and the Greeks and to build upon them. And then we move then to the Renaissance, we move to the Reformation, we move to the Enlightenment. What we're doing, we are a constant process of building here, not erasure, but building. And what we can anticipate as a possibility for the future, and this is me speaking in an optimistic tone of voice, we can anticipate yet a new layer in this tradition, which will take up all the marvelous and precious things and combine them in some new fashion with some new direction and some new imperative. Can I tell you what that is? No, I'm a historian. I'm not a prophet.
I was waiting. Yeah.
Sorry to get your hopes up. I don't have the clue to it. But on the other hand, I don't actually need that, because you might say that the Old Testament gives us some direction in this fashion. You might say that the Old Testament should have ended with the exile into the diaspora, should have ended after the conquest and destruction of Jerusalem that the prophets always warned against. And yet that doesn't happen. Oh yes, there's a scattering of the people of Israel. But what do we see in Nehemiah, in Ezra, even in Esther at a distance? What do we see? We see a reclaiming. We see a Nehemiah and an Ezra coming back to the ruins and rebuilding, doing at a great cost, but reclaiming not only the city, but reclaiming everything that made the city vital to the faith of the Old Testament. So people can talk about Nehemiah. Yes, Nehemiah rebuilding the wall. That's partly what these books are about. But they're also about Ezra. Ezra reading the books of the law and the people listening to them and say, we didn't know this. No one ever taught us this.
Recovering.
And we want to embrace this. All right. Mm-hmm. That is about reclaiming. That is about revitalization. And one thing we would like to point people towards is, even after we have taken them down into the depth, the intellectual exile of anti-civilization, we want to offer the hope. We may yet move into yet a new era, Nehemiah, Ezra, Esther. that promise is there in the example of the Old Testament.
Incredibly well put. I want to ask a couple of questions then about, well, number one, why did you end the book where you ended? There could be another 30 years almost
And probably another 200 pages too. One reason that we ended it where we did, and this was an agreement that Hankins and I came to mutually. These are books of history. We're not pundits, and so we're not writing current events. And I thought it was important to draw the line at 1991. Because that was, in some respects, the ending of a tremendous period of conflict that has its roots in Karl Marx, especially. And 1991 becomes a hinge on which we turn in another direction, and that is to what Sam Huntington called the conflict of civilizations. And yet, we're only at the very beginning of that particular narrative. So I could not begin, I could do no more than introduce that and set the stage of it and say, this is where we're at now. This is the direction in which we are facing. And my dear reader, it is now up to you. And perhaps 20 or 30 years from now, someone is going to write the next chapters of The Golden Thread. And they will be describing how this has been coped with.
Well, for the sake of my grandchildren and all those yet coming, I have to hope that's done well. I do think you make some intimations. I mean, for instance, I find a picture of Khomeini here. So, you know, that you are acknowledging, and you actually also deal with Ketub, you know, and the emergence of terrorism as a methodology. And so, you know, you can draw a line and know exactly what is coming, especially in the larger part of the book. It's astoundingly beautiful. And I just have to tell you, I am very aware that the production of a book of this quality with so many maps, so many beautiful, colorful plates, this had to cost a fortune to produce. This is an enormous investment by the publisher.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
So to whom is this project directed? Tell me, for whom did you write this? Who are you intending to reach?
The specific audience that Hankins and I had in view would be young people, let's say age 17 to age 22. In other words, young people at the most important and formative portion of their lives. The age at which this is the image I like to say, the age at which they are taking the charge in their battery, which is going to sustain them for the rest of their lives. And we had what you might say is upper division high schoolers, maybe 11th, 12th grade, and introductory courses at the college level, first year, second year kind of courses, many of which, of course, no longer exist, but we're hoping that would give people an opportunity to revive that. That's the most immediate audience that we had in view. But I think both Hankins and I also had a larger sense that these are the kind of books that we would like to see picked up by almost anyone. Anyone who has some sense of what has been lost in our times and feels the pull, the hunger to reclaim it, can find it on these pages. So in a sense, Hankins and I are a little bit like Abbe Feria in The Count of Monte Cristo, and we are putting into the hands of Edmond Dantès the secret, the map, the set of clues that will take him to the treasure of Monte Cristo. So that's part of what we're doing in the very broadest sense.
Well, again, I can't commend it enough, because I think not only is all that there, not only is there a coherent understanding of the storyline here, not only is there fairness, I think there's a lot of intellectual, historical fairness in the book, a lot of candor. It's also just a driving narrative, and you don't always expect that. You know, there are certain historians who have a gift for that. I can tell you that the authors of all the books I read on Western civilization in college lacked that gift. They made the fascinating absolutely banal. Mm-hmm. And so it was only when I started looking at the primary sources and started digging into these things myself, and as a young scholar, just realizing this is a far better story than anyone's told. Why doesn't someone tell it better than this?
Well, I will say this, that many of the books that have served as the textbooks for survey, for broad survey courses, whether it's a survey of American history, whether it's older books on Western civilization, tend to be written by committees. And listen, we both know what comes out of committees.
Right.
And usually it's not terribly interesting. What's worse is I have known some examples of books of this sort, which in fact have not been written by the authors themselves, but by their research assistants, by their graduate students. And unfortunately, they bear the thumbprint of that. These two books were written by James Hankins and myself. Volume one by Hankins, volume two by myself. We wrote every word in there is what we wrote. We did not borrow from someone else. We certainly did not use AI. And these are narratives of a story that we wanted to tell, and we took on ourselves the burden and the responsibility of telling it, start to finish. So these are our words, these are our ideas, this is our construction of things, this is our understanding. And it happened, in the case of Hankins and myself, to be a genuine community of interest.
No doubt. And so I want to say, I think there are a lot of parents and young people who are catching the romance of these things by means of the resurgence of classical education and the classical Christian educational model, of which I'm very much a champion. It is the opportunity to recover so much ground that is lost. And I do understand that this would be a lot to put in the hands of a 13-year-old. But I think 16 and 17 and 18-year-olds can grow into this. And I will also say, I think this is going to be for a generation that will give themselves to it what other books have been to me. And that is, I understood them at one level when I was 17. And for that, I'm very, very thankful. But when I went back and read it at 30, I could connect more dots. When I went back and read it at 50, I could connect even more dots. It's worthy of that kind of attention.
If I could be captured by Kenneth Clark at age 17, then these books can capture the 17, 18, 19, 20, on like that.
Absolutely.
And especially young people in the classical and Christian schools and in homeschooling, where there is more, I don't want to quite use the word luxury, but there is more room for this kind of exploration, for this kind of enjoyment, and to see this as a pleasure, because it was a pleasure to write. It's been a pleasure to think on these things as Hankins and I have done so for well nigh 50 years. Now, these books, in some respects, are simply the product of the conversations Hankins and I have had over all those years.
Okay, hold that for a moment. That's very interesting, and I don't know about this. So this comes out at least of some context of the two of you knowing each other.
Yes, yes.
How long have you known each other? Tell me the story here.
We went to high school together. We were in marching band together.
I was not even prepared for that, but all right. But that explains a lot.
We have known each other. We have been wrapped around each other's lives all these years. Wow. I just had dinner with him last night. We have done so. I mean, even our kids, they think of him as Uncle Jim. Okay. So that's how close the relationship has been. But as a relationship, it's always built around these ideas. And
I think that's astounding. I want younger people to hear you just say that and realize that there could be lifetime friendships based upon these ideas and readings and concerns and cultural and theological, urgencies.
Oh, it's the most
that just makes me happy.
I can't begin to tell you how many evenings we would spend sitting there earnestly looking at each other and discussing the fourth movement of Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra. Now, is this because we were some kind of strange geniuses? No, we just loved the stuff, pure and simple.
Yeah, yeah.
We didn't come from the country club types. Mm-hmm. We didn't come from the great, the famous, and the wonderful. We were two kids in a suburban Philadelphia high school, and we just discovered that we loved this stuff and just wanted to know that nothing except talk about it with each other. And we've been doing that, and we'll continue to do it as long as we draw breath. In fact, if people want to see this, so to speak, in action, we have started a Substack, which is, people can access this very easily. Mm-hmm. It's simply the Golden Thread Substack. If you Google the Golden Thread Substack, it will come up. This is a new venture that we've started, and it's Hankins and I talking about all these issues and so many more.
I had no idea you were going to tell us what you just told us. It makes me very happy. One of the things I say, especially to younger men, is that you need to invest yourself in friendships that are going to last a lifetime with these kinds of common passions. And the Lord has given some to me, and I'm just so incredibly thankful for that. The work I'm doing right now in terms of the literary figures after the First World War, and as you know, most famously in the Inklings, as they were known, but that's only one circle. There are three or four or five very interesting circles of friends who worked together for lifetimes on many of these big questions. There was a Catholic circle. There was a London circle, obviously Oxford and Cambridge. You know, Professor Gelzo, I have to tell you, one thing I realized in that is evidently the British are far better at this than the Americans. At least in the 20th century, the British, you had circle, 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 circle. I think the preservation of Western civilization here would have been helped by a similar kind of pattern.
Well, American society is much, much, much more mobile and fragmented than British society has been. So we have had, so to speak, a somewhat different torque powering us that has made that kind of unity much more difficult. But it's not to say that it can't be triumphed over. And perhaps Hankins and I are one example of this. And I have to say, over the years, it's not just been Jim and myself. There have been a number of others who have been part of things that we have done together. But at the nuclear core of it, somehow it is the two of us who still have not exhausted our interests in all of these questions. And the next time we're together, I suppose we're going. What were we doing last night over dinner? We're talking about Leonardo. Mm. So, and we didn't do it because we got together and said, oh, well, you know, it's time that we started talking about Leonardo da Vinci. No, it just popped up. Why wouldn't it pop up? Why wouldn't ordinary people over dinner start talking about Leonardo? Why not? I mean, I must say that makes perfect sense, and not being able to talk about that is, in my mind, perfect nonsense.
I can add nothing to that, but to agree. I have a couple of fanciful questions for you, but they're important.
Okay.
What was the hardest part of this book to write? I have an assumption.
Well, a lot of it hangs on what we mean by the hardest part. I would have to say
the most difficult writing, the part that you had to kind of force yourself to do.
That would definitely be the last chapter.
That's where I felt it, I'll be honest.
And the last chapter, because there it was like It was like describing the aftermath of a deluge. And you could try to be as optimistic as you could get away with. I'm not inclined to get away with optimism if there's no foundation for it. So that last chapter was, yes, that was the most difficult. One particular difficulty within the difficulties was, first of all, finding a title for it. And I finally settled on a line from Auden's The Age of Anxiety. But there are other aspects of it because you've got to describe so much slaughter. And you have to do it in terms that you shrink
So
from
much slaughter
yourself.
yet to come, you already know.
Well, here's an example. All right, I've always taken it as a rule in writing not to interject the first person singular. The only times I will do that is in, for instance, acknowledgments or maybe in an introduction when I'm explaining how I got to write this particular book. But as soon as I move beyond that point, through the narrative sections of the book, to me, invoking the first person, either singular or plural, is a almost a betrayal of the historian's honor code. But I did that in this last chapter. And I did it because I was describing the Nuremberg laws. And I had to describe what the Nuremberg laws did and what they meant, how they applied not only to Jews, but anyone with a Jewish grandparent. And at that moment, I cannot tell you what moved me to do it, but I had to say that these laws would be in effect for anyone with a Jewish grandparent like me. And I think I wrote that and kind of sat back and looked at it and thought, what brought that? What brought that? I'll tell you what it brought out. It was a sense of urgency that I wanted people who were reading this to read this not just as an abstraction, but as something that might strike like lightning in the seat next to them. So yeah, I there was a great it was a great difficulty to describe. To describe Bergen-Belsen and to feel that have I communicated the horror of this sufficiently without being melodramatic? Have I pricked people so that they bleed? That was what I was aiming to do in that chapter, because that chapter, you might say, represents the nadir of this whole process in volume two, this collapse of
Yes.
consciousness.
I think it's incredibly honest of you to write it as you did, and I appreciate so much what you just shared, even about your unprecedented recourse to the first person.
Yeah.
I got to page 805 and read the sentence. This did not sound like the end of history, and the next quarter century would demonstrate all too well how great the challenges to Western civilization would remain. I turn the page, and it's Twin Towers.
That was that curiously. Now I made the comment earlier that Hankins and I wrote this book entirely. Putting the Twin Towers at the very end was actually a suggestion from one of the editors, because we were thinking, all right, what do we want to do? How do we want to round this off? And one of the editors said, I think we should put the Twin Towers, because that everyone's going to come to the end of your narrative
You don't have to use any words.
and turn the page and bang, right there. And I thought, yes, that is exactly the thing. So that's why that appears in the way that it does.
Well, I want to tell you again, it struck me. I turned the page and I thought, yeah, that's I thought it was brilliant, just the whole way it was set up. And it leaves you understanding our task is now to look back at our own civilizational moment and try to reckon with it. Professor Gelzo, it's been such a privilege to talk to you about this book. I know you, so what are you working on next?
Well, I have two major projects in the works. One is writing a new history of the Great Battle of Antietam, September 17th, 1862. So I'm back to the Civil War. And it is a battle which almost beggars description. If only because the two armies involved were so poorly prepared for it. And the fact, the reporting which comes at me over and over and over and over again from the primary materials and descriptions are the incidents of officers and soldiers who ran away, of cowardice. Cowardice because they were utterly unprepared for what they had walked into. So I'm trying to take the measure of what that event was. The other great project are the letters of a captain from the 28th Pennsylvania Volunteers during the Civil War, a young man named James Silliman, who enlisted right at the very beginning of the war, went all the way through the war, rose to the rank of captain in his regiment. He was at Antietam. He was at Gettysburg. He was on the march to the sea with General Sherman and died only 2 months after the end of the war. And his letters, 328 of them, as it turned out, had been in the family ever since then, never consulted by historians. They were the private property of the family themselves, but never accessed by archivists or historians. And we have now embarked on a project for the publication of an edition of the Silliman papers, which offer such an extraordinary view, not only of the military of the Civil War, but also the behind the scenes, the civilian life, the politics, and so on like that. So those are two projects which I think will keep me busy for a while.
It's been such a privilege to have you on the program, Dr. Gelzo. I appreciate so much your model of scholarship and frankly, your very engaging way of even talking about what you've written. And so we're in your debt. I just want to thank you again.
Well, thank you. And all I can say is I love doing this. I have to say it is the kind of thing I think the Lord made me to do.
And I can see that full well and am very thankful for that. Thank you for joining me for Thinking in Public. Many thanks to my guest, Professor Alan Gelzo, for thinking with me today. If you enjoyed today's episode of Thinking in Public, you will find more than 200 of these conversations at albertmohler.com under the tab Thinking in Public. For more information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. Thank you for joining me for Thinking in Public. And until next time, keep thinking.